So I would love to start with timeline wise. I know with Streetlight and the doc about Brian. Give me kind of the timeline of how all these events happen, because you work with a different writer on the Brian one. You've got different editors. I mean, it's completely different teams, but it's the same producers. How did this all come down?
Sure, absolutely. No, and it's you know, of course, it's one of the, you know, the old adage, you know, feast or famine. I think that follows so much, you know, in the entertainment business. This absolutely applies. Streetlight Harmonies, our lead producer, Tim Headington, is just he's a big fan of art and music, and we were discussing one day about projects, and he was just a big fan of doo-wop music, and he said, you know, there's never really been a serious study on doo-wop music. And I did a little bit of research, and we kind of poked around and realized he was right, which I thought was, you know, just didn't seem right. I was a little skeptical at first. So we dove into it, did a little bit more research, and discovered that there was actually a really wonderful story there, you know, with these artists, how short-lived it was, how they were overlooked, the seeds for civil rights that they had kind of planted, and we thought there was a story worth telling, and so we dove into that story and started to tell that story. Then as we were editing that film and, you know, doing that, and of course, the Beach Boys are at the very tail end of that doo-wop era. The very first Beach Boys song, Surfing, you actually hear that, you know, bah, bah, dip, da, dip, you get a little bit of that doo-wop sound. That came with those very early Beach Boys songs. And so we interviewed Brian and Al Jardine and talked about how the music started to begin to evolve, that doo-wop sound began to evolve. And we became friends with Brian's manager, became friendly with her. And as we wrapped up Streetlight Harmonies and finished that up, which was, gosh, I think we finished this film, I want to say, 2 years ago. There was a little bit of overlap. We approached Brian about doing a documentary about him. So there was some overlap, but it was definitely connected, where we just felt like after meeting Brian and working with him, that there was still a little bit to be told with his story. We felt Brian's story wasn't quite complete yet, despite all of the different projects that had been done on him, movies, you know, television shows, and a couple of different documentaries. I thought there was still a tape that could be done. We pitched it to their manager, and they agreed, and we just went right into that production while we were still doing posts on Streetlight Harmonies. So that required a little bit of a shuffling of the crew. And then what we did for Brian was we worked with Jason Fine, who's the editor of Rolling Stone, and Jason Fine became the co-writer on that project based on his history and time with Brian. So yeah, some nice overlap. Very different films, both very, very different projects. Even though they're both music documentaries, they ended up being very different. But it's been an amazing couple of years working on both of them, for sure.
So cool. And I'm based out of Dallas, so we're quite knowledgeable and know all about what Tim Headington's doing and his production company and how important they are.
Oh, great. Oh, yeah, fantastic. Yeah, just Tim, yeah, you know, Tim is just a lover of art, you know. You see those mosaics, and you put the eye in, and there's a lot of stuff with the Dallas Museum. And, yeah, I think, you know, music is just one of those things that Tim loves. And I think he likes the idea of telling these stories that could be lost to time, kind of lost to history a little bit. That was certainly the case with Streetlight. And with Brian, you know, getting up there in age as well, kind of setting the record straight on some of his things. I think kind of Tim is intrigued by those things as well. So he was kind of a huge supporter. And, these two films wouldn't be possible without Tim.
One of the elements I really love about the film is I studied radio in school. And that was what I got into when I first got into the real world, was working at radio stations. And so the background of what you were able to showcase, especially with Alan Freed and his impact on this movement. Can you talk about diving into the different realms of not just the artist and what they brought, but the people that made the music accessible and how that changed very much the way music is looked at today, the way it was, you know, played on on radio and the impact it had on radio, even especially with like Alan Freed, Jocko, and all the different DJs that really changed kind of how music was done.
100%. Yeah, it's really remarkable, I think, sometimes when you think about how art kind of intercedes with technology and in those places and times and what that can do. And this was truly one of those moments, one of those instances where, you know, very much like today with, you know, artists, you know, and singles, you know, buying a 99-cent track on iTunes just changed, completely revolutionized the music industry. This did the exact same thing back in 1955 when 56 when Alan Freed and some of these DJs and Jocko started to play this music for the very first time. It completely revolutionized, you know, the industry, and that's exactly what happened. So, Alan Freed, you know, Jocko, those artists that we profile in the film, we recognized right away that you couldn't tell the story of doo-wop music without telling a little bit of their story and the impact that they had and the courage that it took for them to play black music on white radio. And that's exactly what Alan Freed did. You know, he didn't really care if it was black or white or yellow. He just wanted to play good music, and he wanted to play music that he thought the kids would like. As a matter of fact, I think, you know, we don't get too much into the film, but there's, you know, there's been some documentaries on Alan Freed. He wasn't even really a big fan of rock and roll. He just knew that the kids liked it, and if they liked it, that was good enough for him. And so he recognized that. He took the chances. He was, of course, fired in Cleveland for doing what he did. Went to New York and, you know, went through, you know, industry shunting there as well. But that impact of taking a mainstream radio station, and not a radio station that was all the way at the end of the dial, that was, you know, for black audiences, right? The one that you could barely kind of get in, but to take a strong AM powerful radio station and to play this kind of music, that impact was revolutionary and profound. It changed, it truly changed the world. And then what was fascinating, too, is that this was also the very beginning of television, too. It's just the very, very beginning, the infancy of television. And so there's not a lot of television clips in the film because, unfortunately, you know, it was so early on that there's not a lot of kinescopes of these things, but we're fortunate enough to have one from, you know, Frankie Lyman and the Teenagers, which was, you know, this, you know, Big Bang moment where kids were seeing kids perform and sing for the first time. So now you were seeing them and hearing them, and that changed everything. Now all of a sudden it was like it was no longer Frank Sinatra. It was no longer the Ink Spots. It was like this was a young kid, and you could see him singing. And that impact was just was phenomenal. The inverse of it, of course, and you know, the flip side of that coin was is that as television became bigger and bigger, and Dick Clark, and started right around that same time, and the local hop shows and things like that started to really be very prolific here in the country. You also end up getting the Beatles. And when the Beatles came and they appeared on television, at this time now, a mass audience where everybody in America was watching one show at one time, it absolutely killed the music. Mm. So it helped create it, and at the same time, you know, it helped destroy it. But no doubt about it, Scotty, those guys, Alan Freed, Jocko, and so many of those pioneering DJs revolutionized, you know, popular culture by playing this music and truly having the courage to do it. And so it was important for us to tell that story, I thought, and let audiences know that I think with so much with art, you know, there's always there's other elements of timing. Maybe it's luck, and in this case, certainly technology.
You know, one of the really fascinating elements that you touch upon so well in the doc is the bus tours, not only being big to get the word out about these artists, but it coinciding when they went to the South and the civil rights movement, and in particular the horrors that they had to live through. And you put that in the same point that you brought up with Frankie. These were a lot of times kids. Can you talk about showcasing that, that this wasn't just, you know, adults who were being treated this. These were kids who, for the first time, were leaving their homes, playing music for people that love the music, but they would go to a venue, you know, and they weren't even allowed to look at the audience. They had to look at the wall, which I found fascinating. I mean, the racial divide is terrible, and I'm curious, being able to showcase that, was that an important part of the film for you?
It was, yeah. It was very much. We actually figured that was going to kind of be at the heart of this film. We knew that. I thought that was an element that hadn't been told enough. And I think, as you said, the fact that these were such young kids that were being exposed to, you know, to this kind of racism, it was important to tell that. And I thought what was fascinating as well was that, you know, you hear about some of these elements, but when you hear about it directly from someone who's experiencing it, you see it on camera, and you see their faces, and you can still see the hurt, you know, 50, 60 years later, I thought was really poignant. I also found it fascinating that something that I hadn't considered was that so many of these artists were artists in the Northeast. So, you know, they're from Brooklyn and they're from New York, and, you know, where, you know, once they go below the Mason-Dixon line, you know, there's the world completely changed. And it was, you know, there was a level of racism in the Northeast, and certainly nothing like they experienced in the South and how that affected them. And I found that fascinating that they're, you know, I think it's Lala Brooks, you know, who talks about, like, you know, I'll show you, I'll eat, you know, I'll eat at this counter, you can't tell me what to do. And, you know, one moment, and, you know, and you learn very, very quickly that, no, you can't do that. So to see that, and then to hear the stories, as you said, you know, singing to the wall, where, you know, we're not going to, you know, we're going to mix this crowd with a black audience and a white audience, which is, you know, some of the first times this has ever been done, but we're not going to let you look at them. So that way you can't play to the black side and you can't play by the white side. We're going to make you look at the wall and sing, which is just, you know, just utterly disgusting and idiotic to think that, you know, someone thought that. But then I thought, you know, the more positive aspects of the film is that, again, this was some of the music and these are some of the artists that began to really, you know, blend those lines. You know, I was watching a few years ago, you know, the documentary on the Beatles, you know, 8 days a week, and they talked about playing in Jacksonville and mixing the audience in Jacksonville and how they wouldn't play unless the audience was mixed. I'm thinking, that's 1963. And these guys were doing that in 1957, 1956, long before the Beatles. You know, groups like the Coasters weren't playing to segregated audiences. So I felt, you know, that needed to be told. They needed credit for being the first. And of course, you know, they weren't getting that kind of credit. You know, that was part of, I think, the theme and the heart of the story is that they just weren't getting the credit they were deserved. And so it was important to let audiences know that, you know, it was these kids, these teenage kids, you know, 1956, 1957, who had the courage and had the guts to go down south and play to a mixed audience and ask their promoters to take ropes down that separated these audiences so that they could mingle and dance. And then how those same kids who are, you know, 16, 17 years old dancing, you know, in this crowd, listening to this music, who are going, I don't see anything wrong. You know, how can this person be bad if I like their music? I don't know anything about them, but I like their music. And then a few years later, as the civil rights movement began to grow, you know, those young kids are now young adults, and they're marching and they're signing up voters. And that first exposure to black culture came from the Flamingos, and it came from the directors, it came from Frankie Lyman and the Teenagers. This was the first time black culture was ever allowed into a White House. And I felt again that this was going to be something, this was a story. That the music may make you feel good, it may make you smile, and that's certainly what its purpose is. But they did so much more, and we really wanted those artists to be able to have that kind of credit.
Speaking of those artists, can you let us know how, you know, who was the first one you were able to get? I mean, and I'm talking the older generations, not necessarily like Lance or Brian, those that came, but getting these artists, and, you know, there's so many that have sadly passed. I mean, you have the note in the movie about Benny King and just, you know, a week away. I mean, how tragic is that? But I'd love to know, you know, as far as getting the artists, how did that trickle down?
Yeah, it was really tough, Eddie. It was, you know, first of all, of course, a lot of these artists, you know, they're not on social media, they don't have email, and so they're very difficult to track down. So we had a really hard time, you know, finding them and locating them. And then the second aspect that came with it was they were very skeptical, you know, very cynical about, you know, who are these guys? Who are these people that want to talk to me? And, you know, is this somebody else that's going to try to rip me off and tell my story and, you know, and take advantage of my career? So there was a lot of cynicism in it. And we had to earn their trust. And I think trust is always earned. And, you know, it can never be given. And so in this case, I think it was even more so. So we did. We worked really hard. We did a lot of phone conversations. You know, we spoke to family members. You know, we would do one interview. You know, we would do an interview with, say, a Jimmy Merchant of the Frankie Lyman Teenagers. And, you know, Jimmy, you know, may know, you know, Terry Johnson and the Flamingos. And we would have Jimmy speak to Terry and let him know that it was okay. You know, that, you know, that we weren't there to take advantage of them and that our intentions were true. So it was a really long process. Of course, everybody's spread out, you know, kind of all over the country now. And, you know, that took some time. You know, you do these documentaries on a budget, and you got to try to make it, you know, make it work as best you can. But we wanted to capture as many of these stories as we could. And it did. It took some time, took some convincing, and it was just literally kind of one, you know, one contact would lead to another contact, and one contact would lead to another contact. I thought to tell you the story of what happened with Benny King, which was we had circled Benny King as someone that we had wanted from the very beginning. We knew that, you know, he started very young with the Drifters. He helped revitalize, you know, because the Drifters had been around for, you know, for a few years, but he was able to really revitalize that brand, and was just his contributions to doo-wop was, yeah, immeasurable. So we really wanted him to in the film. So we, you know, called different numbers, different people, trying to reach out to him, could never get a hold of him. And finally, Teresa, our producer, was, you know what, I've got a fax number for him. Because let me just try and see if, you know, maybe he'll respond to this fax. And so we were up in the Northeast doing some interviews. She sent him a fax. And he responded like 5 minutes later. He was still using a fax machine, and that was the best way to reach him. And he responded and said, you know, I'd absolutely love to be a part of this. And then that day, we were getting slammed by a really bad snowstorm. We were up in New Jersey, and he was in New York. I think it was upstate New York. And we were in New Jersey, but we were going to try to make the drive. And then when we found out that, yeah, we probably weren't going to be able to reach him because of the snow that was getting ready to hit. You know, we called back and said, you know, can we reschedule, you know, in a few weeks? And, you know, come back after the snowstorm, you know, dies down. And so we did. We called him up. He said, yep, no problem. And he literally passed away, you know, like a week later. You know, and that was just one example. There were others. A gentleman that sang with the Diamonds, Lee King of the Diamonds. You know, we were on our way up to interview him. We were literally on our way to his house to interview him, and he called and said that he had fallen. And if anybody was okay, you know, I'll be all right. You know, I'm sore today. Let's reschedule. And you hear back from him the next day. He actually had broken his leg. And 2 weeks later, he had passed away. He just never recovered. You know, pneumonia had set in, and we lost him. So it was, I think when you're doing these kinds of documentaries with this generation, you know, it's always a race against time. And it was, you know, we were trying really hard to get as many of these artists as we could, as quickly as we could. And a few of them have passed away since we captured their interviews. I think three or four passed away since we did our interviews with them. So it's we're proud of the fact that we're able to get who we got and when we got them. But it definitely was a challenge.
Well, Brian, thank you for doing that. I think you're allowing the world to get a final voice from those wonderful musical souls. So thank you for that. I would love to know, as far as being able to make this project, was there any catharsis in being able to tell those stories of these veterans of our musical world? I mean, was there a catharsis? And when you look at this doc, you're like, ah, I think we captured something really special here.
All of us are so proud of this film. It was a labor of love, without a doubt. Actually, it was, you know, 3 years, and it took 3 years to make the film. Absolute tremendous labor of love. And to know that, you know, it's still the only film. It's the first one that's been done on this genre, to focus on this artist, you know, means the world to us. For me personally, I had previously done a documentary on World War II fighter pilots, and I had experienced that same kind of sense of pride that comes with telling someone's story that maybe hadn't told it before, that was telling it in the last chapter of their lives, and to hear from their children and their grandchildren, you know, that they learned more about their grandfather, you know, watching this film than they ever did from their grandfather, was tremendous reward, an absolute tremendous reward. And then becoming friends, you know, they were so appreciative. When we debuted at Doc NYC, you know, we were fortunate to have so many of them up there with us for the screening, that, you know, we brought them all up on stage and did a Q&A, and to hear Charlie Thomas thanking us for helping to tell his story, or to hear, you know, Jimmy Merchant say that, you know, he's been getting booked for shows because of this film, and the press it's been receiving, and emails from fans and on his Facebook page. It's been so, so rewarding. So absolutely. I think it's probably, you know, that's at the end of the day, that's why we do these films, is it's just those little moments where you, as a filmmaker, I think you recognize you've been a thread in somebody's legacy, and what an incredible reward that is.
Well, Brent, thank you so much for the time. I love this doc, and I can't wait to see the doc on Brian. And thanks again for making this. It was a really special thing to witness, and hope to get the word out for it for sure.
Oh, thank you, guys. Really appreciate it. Thank you for giving us this time. And, you know, the Brian film will be, hopefully, we're out pitching it right now, out selling it. So hopefully we'll get to do this again here real soon.